welcome back to Back in My Play. This is episode number 38. For this episode, we're going portable while we talk about Super Mario Land 2, the 6 golden coins on the Nintendo Game Boy. And the best thing about the Game Boy is that it's region-free. So I am coming to you from Japan while my two other hosts on this episode are coming from the United States. First off, back on the show from GameSpot, we have Peter Brown, who just finished up from Extra Life streaming some cool games, and freshly shaven now.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me back.
So I got to check out some of the GameSpot. They started first with the live streaming, and they had the Retron 5, and it looked like a sack of your games.
Yes, I was quite nervous about that because I wasn't in the room to monitor. But yeah, 100 games in 100 hours, and our goal is $20,000. I think we're a fair bit over 10K. I don't actually know the exact number, but our friends at Giant Bomb, they did really well. They got much more money than us. So yeah, happy to do it.
Yeah, it's an amazing cause, and so many people are doing it. And with all the crazy stuff that can happen in this industry, in terms of negativity, this is such a positive thing that people can do. And a friend of the show, Greg Stewart, also raised like over $3,000 playing just old Sega games, which is amazing. You know, people always dog on Sega, but tons of people tuned in for old Sega Genesis games and Sega Saturn and Sega Dreamcast games. Greg, hats off to you as well. And back on the show, we have Josh Hillier. Josh, what's up?
Not too much. Yeah, sorry for my absence. I was actually trapped in the basement of Video Games New York, just playing Virtual Boy games, and then they finally realized I was down there and let me out. So back on the show.
Well, I figured you would have gone blind from playing the Virtual Boy or Virtual Boy and just couldn't find your way out of the basement.
Yeah, that's part of the problem. Everything is red. So
Yeah.
Man. My rose-colored glasses, my Virtual Boy rose-colored glasses.
I still, the first game I ever imported, well, I didn't import it. It was from, the EB Games picking up Virtual Boy games from Japan for like $3 of some baseball game and some like a vertical, like 3D, it was probably a vertical shooter. But those were my first two ever imports because, again, region-free. Remember that, Nintendo? Remember you used to do that?
I don't think they remember.
No, they don't. They don't remember a lot. They forget real quick. But we're here to talk about one of the gems of their, one of their first portable consoles. Of course, you go back to your Game & Watches, but this is the first portable game that we've talked about. Of course, we hit on the Neo Geo Pocket Color as a whole back with... actually, that was with Mike Micah, who we had on the show to talk about that. So that was a crazy episode. But we're here to talk about the old black and white classic. So what we're going to do is stitch in a bunch of music, and we're going to be coming back with the history of Super Mario Land 2. So stick around. We'll be right back. Let's talk about the history of Super Mario Land 2. And the first question that you're going to have is, why aren't we talking about Super Mario Land 1? And I'm going to just briefly say that I find that this game to be it is what they wanted to do on the Game Boy when it came to Super Mario Brothers or Super Mario games. And I just, Super Mario Land 2, it's an interesting game, but it's like 15 minutes long, and it's a lot harder to talk about for an episode, so maybe we'll save that for another day. But for Super Mario Land 2, it came out in North America on November 2nd, 1992, and in Japan on October 21st, 1992. Of course, developed by Nintendo, and this is a really interesting game because Super Mario Land 2 was created by director Hiroji Kiyotake, rather than, of course, the series creator Shigeru Miyamoto. And this is the first game that introduced us to Wario, who is the villain of the game. He takes over Mario's castle, and, you know, hijinks ensue. You have to fight a bunch of bosses and so on. But this game was gigantic for the Game Boy. It was a 4 megabyte or megabit cart, and it was one of the largest Game Boy games at the time of its release. And just for context, it was 8 times larger in terms of capacity than Super Mario Land. So you have obviously much bigger sprites. You have much more content in the game. The music was composed by Kazumi Totaka, and it's one of his earliest works. Totaka's song is also hidden in the game and can be heard in the game over screen after waiting for exactly 2 minutes and 30 seconds, so an Easter egg in there. The game's concept was really taken from, and this has been talked about when it comes to Link's Awakening, with these kind of like middle of the generation Game Boy games in 1991, 92, 93, the goal was to really take the expectations that people have from late NES games and early Super Nintendo games and translate that experience to the console. That's why you see a lot of carryover in terms of the mechanics in Link to the Past and Link's Awakening. And same thing with Super Mario Brothers 3 and Super Mario World when it comes to Super Mario Land 2. So you have 6 zones or 6 worlds. Each one has, you know, about 3, 4, 5 levels. And at the end, you have a final castle, if you want to call it that, where at the end, if you beat the boss, you get access to, you're given a coin. Once you have all 6 coins, you are then able to open the gate to Wario's castle, which is really Mario's castle that Wario took over. For whoever knows why, you should probably look at the back of the box to see why. And one interesting fun fact is that this game, you know, Nintendo Power, I mentioned in the past, like, people say Nintendo Power was owned by Nintendo, but they gave some pretty hard reviews. Like, they were the edge of its time when they were harsh in the review scores. And it got a 3.7 out of 5 in Nintendo Power. Like, that is, if you want to be a butthead and translate it to the 10-point scale, we're talking like a 7.4. You know, it's not not a super, super great score. But, very, very interesting history with this game, and just kind of ushered in the next generation of Game Boy games. So Josh, I don't know if you had anything to add to any of that.
I don't, except that it's just amazing how much better Super Mario Land 2 is than Super Mario Land 1. I mean, you know, just in terms of just understanding the hardware, this really stands out. So, you know, it does feel sort of like the leap from NES to SNES. So that's interesting that you were talking about the whole Link to the Past to Link's Awakening and Super Mario World and Super Mario Land 2. The difference is pronounced because I played both of them last night just to sort of see if that's indeed the case.
Peter, I don't know if you had anything to add on top of that before we jumped and moved on.
Well, yeah, just reiterating what you guys were saying, at least in terms of some of the mechanics that are present in Super Mario Land 2, I think anyone who played Super Mario World on the Super Nintendo would immediately recognize that this is a great sort of portable follow-up. And I think we'll get to this in a bit, but it's also very different from a lot of Mario games, and I think that's pretty special.
Yeah, if you want to just even talk about the mechanics, just even having like the spin jump, trying to carry over a lot of that stuff from Super Mario World into Super Mario Land 2. And, we'll talk about it a little bit, but just in terms of like the back in the box stuff, it's just very interesting to look at how they marketed this game, and just it had such a much more of a Super Mario Brothers 3, Super Mario World look to the box art and things like that compared to Super Mario Land. But yeah, this is something we'll talk about in a little bit. So yeah, we're going to take another break. So listen to some more awesome stereo music from the Game Boy, and we'll be right back with our personal memories and history with the game. Okay, so we're traveling all the way back to 1992. We're getting ready for the holiday lineup from Nintendo. Of course, the biggest thing out there right now is the Super Nintendo, but don't forget about that portable powerhouse in the Game Boy. And if you start looking at really the track record, just to step back for a second and talk about how amazing the lifespan of the Game Boy was. When you talk about, you know, even like 10-year lifespans of consoles, with as a portable, this thing had an incredible life, you know, all the way up to, of course, like 1998 and 99 with the when they brought over Pokemon from Japan, the iterations of the hardware from the original gray brick to the Play It Loud consoles to the Game Boy Pocket, and if you're in Japan, the Game Boy Light with your if you haven't had a watch at the time with Indiglo with that technology built in. So just an amazing piece of hardware. So we're not going to talk about the hardware so much. We're going to talk about the game. So I want to throw it to you first, Peter, to kind of get your history with the game, and just even like at the time, 92 with the Game Boy and things like that.
Yeah, I had a Game Boy really early on. And the two games that I spent most of my time with were Tetris and the original Super Mario Land. I used to have to go on a lot of road trips. My sister played college sports. My parents felt the need to take me to all of her games on the weekends. And so I spent a lot of time with Mario Land. But then when I eventually got Mario Land 2, it was that sort of that eye-opening experience of, wow, like look what they've done with a Game Boy game. I mean, it just over the course of, I think, just a couple years, they really found a way to sort of mature that Mario formula in a portable way. And I loved it. You know, I didn't have a Super Nintendo. I was a Genesis kid, which I have mixed feelings about. but yeah, so it was great to kind of find those games that were still, you know, Nintendo oriented. Hmm. And that got me excited.
You have mixed feelings about being a Genesis kid? Yeah. I'm sorry. I found that interesting.
Yeah. Well, so these days I actually am spending a lot of time playing Genesis games, but as a kid, I wasn't as aware of the entire library of games out there. And maybe even my tastes weren't that diverse at the time. Hmm. And I had a friend, I think we talked about this during the Star Fox episode, where I would go over to his house and play his Super Nintendo, and had always lamented because it was up to me to get a Genesis or a Super Nintendo. And I always felt whenever I'd go to his house, like, man, I made the wrong decision. Because I grew up with an NES before the Genesis. And so I guess I felt like I was missing out. So the Game Boy was a good way to kind of keep in tune with the stuff that I love so much.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, no, that is a really interesting contrast. Just to thinking about, you know, today we have the 3DS and the Wii U. You can get a lot of great Nintendo experiences on the 3DS. Even like with Super Mario 3D Land, which one of the best games ever. So, yeah, and I totally forgot to mention, I apologize for retconning this a little bit, if that makes sense in terms of a term, but in terms of the six zones, I wanted to mention that you know, there was some diversity with those, with tree zone, space zone, macro zone, as a callback to your, you know, big world from Super Mario Brothers 3, pumpkin zone, turtle zone, and of course Mario zone. So sorry, I just want to put that in there before I forgot. Over to you, Josh.
So 1992, this was a game that I received from my parents, didn't know it was out. I was 8 years old at the time, and I played this game to death, sort of the same situation that Peter was describing, in which you have a Game Boy and you travel a lot, and we did. We would go visit family, kind of spread out all over the Southeast, and nothing as cool as college sports or anything like that, though. So we were just going to visit. And I played a lot of Tetris, a lot of the RC Pro-Am game on Game Boy, if you guys know which one I'm talking about. It came with a link cable pack-in.
Yeah, four
as well.
Players. Yeah,
exactly. And so some friends had that, and we would play it sometimes. And then both of the Mario Land games, and then some movie games as well. But I just remember playing it and thinking, man, this is so good. Like, this is just so... I was just blown away that the hardware was pulling that off, you know, like it didn't even make sense to me. I wasn't all that great at games at that point, though. So I actually had to have my dad help me out with some things. And that's kind of a fond memory I have as well, because my dad's passed away. So it was kind of neat thinking back to that as I played this game over the last week, to him tagging in from time to time, because for whatever reason, and I think this is still the case with people in like tablets today, there's something about a handheld device being a little bit more inviting than sitting down with a console. And so he didn't want to play console games with me, but he would mess around with the Game Boy. And he had some sort of natural platforming skills. So that was sort of a fond memory of him helping me get through Pumpkin Zone and stuff like that, that for whatever reason I was struggling a bit with. Iconic enemies. I just remember a lot of things about this game. And it was sort of like muscle memory playing it again after all these years. You know, just like apparently I played it a lot as a kid, because I still remembered so many of the things. Probably more than any game we've ever played on Back in My Play. That I remember, like, pretty much everything about this game. So it was sort of like revisiting the house you grew up in, like, 20 years later.
Yeah, remind me to call back to your muscle memory of this game, because I'm interested to see what your thoughts were on how it plays in the next segment. But
definitely,
when it comes to this time period, like it. It was weird because I got that was a Christmas. I also got a Game Gear, was 92, because this is an interesting period in my life, because it was the time that my parents got divorced. So it was the year my parents got divorced. So we got spoiled like a mother, when it came to Christmas that year. Like that was the year that I got Link to the Past. I got my Game Gear. And I got I got Home Alone 2 or some garbage like that on Super Nintendo, which unfortunately I played a lot, but, when it came out, I was in Game Gear mode because I got this new hardware. So I had to support it, outside of just having World Series Baseball and Sonic 2 that I came with. So, I kind of missed out on this game until my cousin got it, and I ended up borrowing it from my cousin. And in terms of borrowing it, it was like, my aunt didn't let me borrow games. Like, I had to play it at his house. So I would have to bring my Game Boy over, and whenever we got together, I just kind of play it when I could. And I never got the full experience. And because of, budgetary concerns, like, when you got access to a game like that and you got to play a little bit of it, it was hard for me to justify, like, if an opportunity came up, like a birthday or a Christmas or a special occasion to get a game, I couldn't justify the $30 that would go towards this game. Instead, I would get something else, on the Game Boy or for the Super Nintendo or the Game Gear.
Because you'd already played it.
It was like the game that you rented, and I just couldn't justify, buying it. And it's just at that time, like, we got spoiled at Christmas, but our family was not very well off. We weren't doing great financially. So if we got a game, it was like one game for birthday, one game for Christmas. And I just couldn't do it. So anyways, I did get to play a decent chunk of it, but I didn't have a lot of nostalgic memories for it. Again, it was just my memories for it are really from Nintendo Power. It was from seeing it in Nintendo Power and seeing the art design, and again, like I mentioned earlier, how much it matched up with what I was seeing in Super Mario World, which of course, since I had Super Nintendo, I was playing the crap out of. And that was the thing that surprised me a lot, is just seeing how the things were changing in terms of the games that were coming out for the Game Boy. Like, you talk about 91 92 93, and so on, like I said, going up to like Pokemon came out in 98. So you're having all these great games come out that are just squeezing as much as they possibly can out of this hardware, not just graphically, but in terms of, you know, the audio. Like, you had in 91 games, like another game that I picked out since I've been out here in Japan, Castlevania 2 on the Game Boy, which sounds incredible on the Game Boy hardware, which, you know, I think one of the episodes that we did a while back, I mentioned, you know, how the sound hardware on the Game Boy was really impressive later on. And then someone emailed in and said, actually, like, it is literally the sound hardware from the NES, you know, more or less, like, just shrunken down. So it should be able to do a lot of what the NES is capable of doing. So I really shouldn't be surprised. And of course, you know, with the people that worked on it, with Gunpei Yokoi and I believe it was Hip Tanaka working on the sound hardware, which I'm going to get to see in a couple weeks at the Digging Into the Cards concert. Can't wait for that.
Nice.
The game itself is just a huge showcase of what the hardware is capable of doing. So that was just what stood out for me, and what I got out of it most was, yeah, it felt like Super Mario Brothers 3 or Super Mario World shrunken down. Although it just didn't have a huge part in, you know, in my heart in terms of my nostalgic memories. So it was more just a case of, if I had the money, I would have been great to own it. And even I remember seeing it when it hit that greatest hits, you know, label, when it was only $20, and just thinking, like, at the Kmart, like, maybe I can grab it. But again, it's $20, like, $20 as an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old is a ton of money. So I was never able to pull it off, but it was available luckily today on you know, your 3DS eShop, or for 600 yen in your local shops in Akihabara.
Do you remember, Kevin, how far you got into the game, like when you would go to your aunt's house?
It would just be playing a couple levels, because it was not just that he had that I didn't have. He had a bunch of games that I didn't own. So it was time budget of, you know, being able to shuffle a bunch of games that he had. Like, he had Double Dragon on the Game Boy 2, which I loved, which was it's probably a bad port. But just being able to play Double Dragon in the car, like, we were the two, like, me and my cousin, you know, Chris, who I talked about when I mentioned MC Kids and things like that. Like, we were locked in terms of the Game Boy. My aunt and uncle are great, but they had this odd rationalization that they did not want their son to own a home console. They did not want him to be playing video games in front of a TV, but they had no problem buying him a Game Boy and a ton of games for it. So that is all he had. So he had a ton of games for it. And that's why whenever I went over there, and same thing, they got him a Game Gear too. They just did not want him to have, you know, that thing where you would be stuck in front of the TV. They wanted them to go outside. They're very outdoorsy. So that's why I was always just shuffling through whatever every games he had.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, it's, you know, portable games are always interesting to think about, because it is not only, you know, something that you would have locked into a memory at home, but like a trip, like you would go on, or like I was saying, like, you share it with your cousin. It's so much easier to borrow a portable game where you can just, you know, pop it out of your Game Boy, put it in your pocket, and or share at school and play games at school and stuff like that. So that's why it's always an interesting thing to look back on.
That's neat when you think about our three stories, though. You know, Peter's talking about playing it on road trips to see his sister play college sports.
Yeah.
I'm talking about playing it on road trips to see various family members, which is part of the reason my dad would play it in the first place, was because I guess there was nothing else to do, like, you know, at whoever's house we were visiting. And you're talking about playing it, like, when visiting a cousin specifically. You know, this is the one case in which, like, everybody, none of us have this memory of playing it at our own houses.
Yeah, the Game Boy was so important for me as a kid, just in terms of having it for, like you said, car rides, or, you know, knowing you're going to be going to a relative's house or grandparents' house, that you can't lug the NES with you, you can't lug the Super Nintendo with you, but you can bring a Game Boy and kind of get away with playing it while you're there.
Did you guys get new Game Boys over time, or did you have to stick with the same
Game Boy? Hell yeah.
You did? Lucky.
Yeah, I had to trade in stuff to get them, but I definitely kept up with the times.
Me too. As soon as that Game Boy Pocket came out and like the commercials hit on that, it's like, you know, 50% smaller, you know, twice the battery life, way better screen. And awesome looking colors. I've talked about on the show about how, you know, I ended up getting, I traded in a bunch of Beanie Babies for a Game Boy camera, and I got that red Game Boy camera to match my red Game Boy Pocket. And then when Pokemon came out, I got the red Pokemon game to match my red Game Boy Pocket. Like, I don't know why I went with red. I think it was probably because it was the only color they had in stock, because like Game Boy Pockets were selling like crazy. And like Peter did, I traded in a bunch of games and my old Game Boy to get a Game Boy Pocket. So it was probably, you know, just what they had left at the store. And I'm like, well, I'm training this stuff in. I'm not leaving this store without a Game Boy.
You talked about the Game Boy Light earlier. When I was really young, my brother was living in New York City during an internship, and I went to go visit him, and we went to a used import game store, and I saw the Game Boy Light, and I was just amazed by it, because it had the indigo sort of backlighting going on. And to this day, I've always wanted one, and I've never picked it up. I almost did. I guess we'll get to this later. I almost did during my last trip to Japan, but it was like just too scuffed up. Yeah. I was like, no, this isn't the one to
own. Is it the one you saw at Super Potato?
No, it was at Retro Game Camp.
Oh, I was going to say, I saw one at Super Potato that was like $80 or $85, but yeah, it was like beat to crap.
Oh, yeah. See, that's a fair price for a decent one, but yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting
game
console
that got away.
Yeah, and it's if you're listening to the show and you don't want to get out to Japan, I've seen them a lot on eBay, you know, for around like $100-ish, and it's an interesting novelty. I've seen one in action, and I just didn't like the look of the indigo on the, you know, black, you know, pixels or whatever, but sure. You know, it's been fun to play it on a Game Boy Pocket for this, but that's for the next segment. Can't talk about that now. So yeah, this is, I never thought I would get so happy to talk about the Game Boy, and you've been putting it off for a year and a half, but, yeah, here's your Game Boy game. I just want to say, yeah, in terms of that 91, 92, 93, like those are when Castlevania 2 was coming out, DuckTales, like Capcom was kicking ass with the DuckTales games, Darkwing Duck, Bionic Commando coming out in the Game Boy. Of course, they had Demon's Crest? What?
Gargoyle's Quest and Demon's...
Quest, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got it.
So there was just so much great stuff. And Gargoyle's Quest, just talking about borrowing that from a friend and just not even realizing how much of a like rarity that game was, but just like how you would find games as a kid, not read reviews, but you would just play it and know it's fantastic. It's something I miss too, because now a game comes out and you see a form on NeoGAF and there's, you know, 92 Metacritic, 81 Metacritic. So you already know if it's really good or not. You're not surprised anymore, but, yeah, let's take a break. This has been fun, but we got a lot more to talk about. We got to go back to the future and talk about revisiting this game. So stick around. We'll be right back with that. Whatever year it is, and you know what? What's great about the Game Boy hardware compared to the Game Gear is that screen is just as good. as it was 20 years ago, and you can find plenty of Game Boys out there that work perfectly and that don't need cap kits. So that's one up for all the Nintendo fans out there. But this is a very interesting game to go back to, and you know, with a lot of the stuff that we do on this podcast, it's a lot easier to go back to console games, portable games. It's always interesting to see how they hold up. So I can't wait to get into this discussion. So, Josh, I want to go to you first. First off, how did you play this game? Did you succumb to the Nintendo eShop of no account system and pick this game up there, or did you pull out the old brick that can survive Desert Storm?
I played it a little bit both ways because I have it on both platforms for whatever reason. So,
You did the Super Game Boy. You should have done Super Game Boy, man.
Oh, that would have been cool. Yeah, and I do have a Super Game Boy, so I could have done that, but I guess I was too lazy. So I played it both ways. Ultimately, I like playing it on the Game Boy a little bit more because you cannot remap the controls, as we've discussed before.
Amen, brother.
Yeah, so, you know, if you want to hold the run button and jump while, you know, being forced to only use B and A on the 3DS, it's just not comfortable because of the, you know, like, sort of diamond layout of the buttons. It's just not comfortable.
I'm so sorry. I don't mean to ever bring that stuff up, but this is just the simple things. Nintendo does so much so great, so well. Like, we were talking about Japan off the air. They do so many things so well, but it's these little things that I'm like, why do you do it that way? Just let me remap my controls like you do on the Game Gear ROMs that you put on the eShop.
Yes, because if I could just hold X to run.
Yeah, I know, man. I know.
Life would be so good. Life would be so good.
I feel it.
So anyway, I ended up playing it a little bit more on my Game Boy Color, which, you know, that's a fine way to play it. I have one of the bright green ones, so it's sort of charming to go back and play
on. Nice. Those are super good looking consoles.
Yeah, that's the whole play it loud period.
Does it do the Super Game Boy thing to it when you play old Game Boy games in it? Does it color it a little bit?
I don't know if I wasn't doing something right, but no, not in my case.
Okay.
There are actually a few Game Boy games that allow that to happen.
Okay.
One of them being R-Type DX. I think it's usually the games that have the DX designation.
Oh yeah, it's the solid black carts.
So yeah, like Tetris DX, I believe, right? A few other games.
Oh, that's a bummer. I was hoping it had the super, because I know if you go with a Game Boy Advance, which I said correctly that time.
Way to be.
It does have the Super Game Boy, you know, whatever architecture or, you know, programming in it to colorize some of the Game Boy games.
Yeah, it's really weird though, you know, like those colors that it comes up with.
Yeah.
When you're playing on Super Game Boy.
Well, even if you do like on the Game Boy Advance, like if I throw in Metroid 2, it's like pre-programmed to color it a certain way, so it actually looks like Super Metroid.
Hmm. Well, okay. I can buy that.
So not for all the games, but some.
Gives you sometimes, yeah. Right? I mean, those are kind of cool. But yeah, Super Mario Land 2 holds up really nicely wherever you're playing it, even if you do have to play it on the virtual console. It's only $4 there.
Yeah.
So a very fair price for the game, for the amount of content that you get. There's totally. Some Game Boy games that I think that a $4 price tag is horrible.
Yeah.
But you know, in the case of Super Mario Land 2, that's a bargain. So go
pricing
out and pay
structure it. Of virtual console for another day.
Yes, it should be variable depending on the game itself. I agree. Let publishers decide.
Don't make too much sense, Josh. Don't make too much sense.
I know. I have a real problem with that. It's making sense.
Well,
you know?
With the people listening to this show, like our group, you know, specifically, like this is it's just a problem because, you know, a game that, you know, is to the scope of Final Fantasy 6 or 3 or whatever should not be the same price as, you know, a piece of garbage like Final Fight. That's right. All I'm trying to say.
Yes, yes. What about Urban Champion?
That's the NES version. It's Urban Champion is to Final Fight as Super Mario Brothers 3 is to, like, Super Mario World.
Wow. I followed that. Okay, yeah, I buy that. Well said.
So what'd you think? How does it, you know, what'd you think of the experience? Were you able to, you know, get that muscle memory? Because I wanted to ask you how you thought it felt, because for me, I thought it like everything was really solid about the game, but I thought the physics were a little iffy.
Well, okay. So, and as an experiment, I went back and played last night specifically. I played Super Mario Land 1 and I played Mario Land 2. And trust me, man, the physics are so much better in Mario Land 2.
Oh, but I mean, when you compare it to what they were shooting for with, like, the Super Mario Brothers 3, Super Mario World, you know, look and feel, I thought it still felt a little floaty, like almost not to the point of your Little Big Planets, but maybe a little bit more towards the new Super Mario Brothers kind of feel to it.
Yeah, I buy it. I buy that. It's not as tight as Super Mario 3 or Super Mario World, but it's definitely a step in the right direction in terms of emulating that experience. And I don't know how much of it was intentional to try to make it feel a little bit different. But, you know, like you said in the history segment, they certainly were going for, you know, like handheld versions of the more recent games in each series. So probably they had to make some concessions, I suppose. Like, it's just incredible to me, though, that the sprites look so good, you know, just like all of it. It just looks good.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I immediately pretty much remembered everything except for like some of the later stuff. But like in the early levels, you know, like the stuff I played more as a kid anyway, I remembered like where some of the hidden blocks would be right away, like in one of the early levels in Tree Zone, I believe it is. There's a couple of blocks you can hit and sort of go up and up vertically, and then you run across the top of the level across a lot of blocks. So I remembered where that was right away, having not thought about the game in a couple of decades probably. So that was kind of neat to have that experience, not stumbling upon the stuff, but just sort of like walking back into my old house, like I was talking about earlier. Mm. And like some of the things that we haven't really seen in the series since this game are really cool, like the bubble that you can get in and kind of float around that comes out of, what is that thing, like a hippopotamus? Does anyone know what that is?
Oh, the statue. Yeah, the statue thing.
Yeah, very.
I don't know, man. Like it's a very very low pixel count.
Well, yeah. I mean, seriously. So it's hard to tell exactly what that is. I'm sure that if I got on a Mario wiki or read up on some of the lore, I could find out. But anyway, like that just feels great. Like floating underneath blocks in a bubble. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. There's so many interesting, you know, traversal mechanics that they implement in this game from world to world. Like the diversity is very impressive for, you know, the console that it's on.
And it works.
Yeah.
You know, like it works. And not only that, I want to ring bells instead of grab flags, I realized while playing this game. There's something, I don't know if it's like a Pavlovian, however you pronounce that word, response or something.
Way better than jumping into just that high door in Super Mario Land.
Yes, yes. Everything about this game is better than Mario Land 1. And I don't want to just trash that game. Like, you know, it was made in what, 88?
89.
Okay. You know, so, I mean, it was pretty impressive for the time, maybe. I don't even know. Yeah, maybe I'm just being nice here.
I played a lot of that game, and the only interesting part of Super Mario Land, and why we're never going to do an episode on it, is just like the side-scrolling shooting stuff, like when you're in the submarine and the ship and stuff. That's pretty cool.
That game also had a wonderful soundtrack, though.
I think it did. The ending theme is just kick-ass. Maybe I'll even use that for this show, just because it's so good. But
Super Mario Land 1?
I might just use it like as a super, like a post credits. If you want to stay for the song after the song, you can listen to that.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's like when the club is closing, has already tried to close once.
Yeah.
And now they're like really kicking people out.
Yeah.
Okay. I buy that. What if that's what they played at clubs when they were trying to get people to go home?
They do at the 8-Bit Cafe.
Nice. Okay. No, I can see that. But sort of final things that, you know, there are a couple things I noticed now that I'm old. So like when you're jumping in the air and falling down and firing fireballs, the game does have, it chugs. It has a little bit of slowdown going on. So for as nice as it is and how well the game runs, it does struggle a bit there, which isn't that surprising, of course, considering the hardware that it's on. But that's really my only complaint, you know, just the occasional slowdown that I notice. Other than that, it's just it's a joy to play. I think it's one of the best handheld Mario games, if not the best handheld Mario game, because now they've been on the new Super Mario Brothers train for a while. And
jeez, yeah.
Most of the advanced ones we got were just remakes of the NES games.
Or yeah, we never got a Super Mario Brothers game on the Game Boy Advance that was original. It was just the Mario games.
Yeah, which were great, certainly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it would have been nice to have had a proper Mario game. So like this game really distills the Mario formula, kind of like New Super Luigi U does, you know, these bite-sized levels, because most of the levels are super fast in this game. And I feel like I wrote this down while I was playing the game. Like, it's just really nice to play Mario levels that are well designed like this, that are just tight and concise and to the point, say what they need to say in, you know, like in 90 seconds or whatever. I kind of feel like this is what 2D Mario games should be.
Peter, what do you think?
So I started playing it on the Super Game Boy.
Nice.
And wow. I noticed that the scrolling was very pronounced, like the sort of choppiness. But when you play it, when I went back and then played it on a Game Boy Pocket, much better. And I was just reminded of, again, like how impressive this is on the Game Boy, like given so much of what we're used to, and especially that I guess I've had more experience with Super Mario Land, the original. So this was great. And one of the things for me that really stood out is the originality in the enemies and the level design that is sort of not really been reproduced. Like, I mean, obviously we get Wario, like he's introduced and that's very interesting. And then all the bosses, since they're not Koopalings or anything, it's a whole new experience. It's all these original characters. And I think Pumpkin Zone was probably my favorite. Going there and seeing the creativity in the enemy designs was really nice.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, yeah. But it's definitely a game that belongs on a handheld. And to what Josh was saying about the, you know, the brevity of the levels, I think that's, I don't know if I would want that on a console experience, but for handheld, it's perfect. And it definitely is a game that you felt like these sort of rapid accomplishments, but also you get to quickly see new things that keeps it, you know, and that keeps it interesting. So I thought it was a great game to go back to, honestly.
Peter, did you play New Super Luigi U?
I did. I reviewed that, actually.
Okay. Okay, and so I was just wondering, like, did you feel like that was chopping up the Mario formula too much with that being on a console, or because that was a one-off, like, you know, $20 expansion pack, it was okay?
For me, the most important thing about that game was the difficulty, which was scaled up pretty high relative to a lot of Mario games, and I thought that fit the format of the shorter levels pretty well. But it wasn't the brevity so much as it was the difficulty. But I guess the two do play in hand in hand. So that's a good reminder.
Well, no, I buy your point though, because Super Mario Land 2 is fairly easy. You know, I realize
it is. Yeah.
Again. So, you know, at least New Super Luigi U has that going for it with its quick levels.
Yeah, this is a weird game. Because I found some of the things that you didn't like, Josh, like the slowdown. One thing, you know, this is probably, you know, a good point. Neither of you guys mentioned anything about the rabbit suit, because it really doesn't do anything. It just helps you float on the way down. And that, you know, I'm sure they tried to implement, you know, the flying mechanics of something like a Super Mario Brothers 3 or World, but just with the limits of the hardware to make levels big enough to even, you know, make that fun or interesting, there was really no way to do it. So instead we got kind of the ability to have almost a Princess Peach, you know, float from Super Mario Brothers 2 in the game in terms of a mechanic. But yeah, just for me, it was fun to, before we even did this, like I was lucky. I went to Akihabara just to make sure I could get a copy of it first, which there's copies all over the place. But I was just happy to stumble upon a Game Boy Pocket for like $15 in really great shape. And that is the best way to play it. I just forgot my red Game Boy Pocket back home. And the game does really look good. It's just like a zoomed in Super Mario Brothers, you know, 3, if you want to call it that. But with the thing that Josh mentioned, if there's more than two or three enemies on the screen at once, it starts chugging. Like, this is a Game Boy game, and this is something that you see across a lot of Game Boy games, whether it be Contra on the Game Boy or like I've been playing a lot of Castlevania 2 on the Game Boy. You'll usually just have one enemy or two enemies at the most to attack on the screen at once. One, due to processing power, but two, because of screen size and real estate, where if you want to have really nice detailed character characters in the game, you can't fit, you know, more enemies on the screen anyway, so there's no point in, you know, designing the levels that way. I will say that the sound effects are pitch perfect. They sound exactly like, you know, the sound effects for fireballs and for jumping, coin pickups. Everything sounds like it's coming from an NES Super Mario Brothers game, which I really appreciated from coming from Super Mario Land 1, which I also picked up while I was in Japan, where it sounds bad in terms of the sound effects. There's some good songs, there's some decent songs in that game, some decent tracks, but the sound effects are really lackluster. And just to talk about being able to have a actual fire flower and not like that bouncy ball garbage from Super Mario Land 1, which you love it or hate it. Like, it's interesting. It bounces, you know, on the walls, and you can like have special angles, like a pool shot to try to hit enemies. But, you know, for me, like mostly with Super Mario Land 1, it's just you bounce it and then you just go straight up into the sky and you get to angle things really weird to attack enemies. So anyways, I did so. I really enjoyed it. And the diversity throughout the game is super impressive. Like, not just the ways where you're going from, like you go to Spaceland and you are having to deal with gravity on the moon and how you can literally just jump like super high, and you have to do a much better job at timing your jumps to make sure that you're not hitting projectiles or obstacles that are in the sky that can affect you, that can damage you. And there's really good enemy diversity. You go to, like Peter was mentioning, you go to the pumpkin zone and the enemies are all completely different. They're really just skins of other enemies. Like, your Goombas are just reskinned, but it does help to have like kind of messed up stuff like a Jason mask with a knife going through it.
I know. Yeah.
And that is just a sign or just an example of what Nintendo does with portable versions of their main franchises and why they are sometimes better than the console versions because of how weird they can get. And that's why, you know, with Super Mario Land 3, like Wario Land, Super Mario Land 3, they're just like, we're going to make Wario games and they're going to be completely different. So we can do something that's just different than what people are getting from the consoles, whether it be crazy power-ups or the dash attack that you get in Wario Land. But that is just one trend that you'll see, I guess, until new Super Mario Brothers. But then in Super Mario 3D Land, you're seeing really interesting mechanics in that game. And I still think that might be one of the top one, two, or three games on the 3DS hardware, where it is just, it looks beautiful and it is just a lot of fun to play. But the last thing I really wanted to mention is that this game is it's easy for a lot of parts, but I was getting to towards the end where I, you know, got through all the lands. I'm getting ready to go to Wario's place and I run out of lives. I get a game over. And what you don't realize when you get a game over, you still get to have all of your levels completed, but then you lose all your coins. So you have to go back to the final stages of each world and rebeat all the bosses, which is fine. I think that's, you know, it's fair. It doesn't take that long. The bosses are pretty easy in general. But it makes you have some sort of strategy. So, you know, you might want to just, if you're playing this for the first time, don't beat the final stages of those levels. Beat all the other levels first, rack up a ton of extra lives in the bonus stages and things like that, and then go fight those final bosses in each one of the, you know, individual zones, and then go to Wario so you can have a ton of lives stacked up. Because, you know, that... another thing I want to mention in terms of like Super Mario World, like there's secret exits. There's secret exits in some stages. Yeah. There's extra levels. Like, man, like that is why it feels so much like a Super Mario World or Super Mario. I guess they didn't do it in Super Mario Brothers 3, but at least in Super Mario World. So did you guys find any of those secret exits? Peter, did you find any of those?
Yeah, there was one. I mean, yes, I can't remember exactly where they were offhand, but some of them are pretty easy to find. Yeah. I mean, it's just an alternate path that's right there. And then it takes you to, like the one world I played, it took me to an auto-scrolling level, which is it might be the only one I remember encountering.
I think there's two.
There's two,
There's one really early on as well.
Okay. I guess, you know, I kind of wanted to throw a note out there too that we haven't mentioned is the fact that coins, like your generic coins you pick up, those were used to get into the bonus games. You would essentially buy your way in.
Yeah,
I found that really interesting because I had totally forgotten about that aspect.
For the I guess you would call it a roulette wheel.
Right.
And you place your bet, and the more that you bet in terms of coins, whether it be 30, 50, 200, or 999, you have the opportunity to get greater prizes, whether it be like a power up or, you know, five extra lives, or I never got to the 999 level.
Right.
But I'm sure that is an extravagant prize when you if you do win it.
I like that a lot more than just getting 100 coins and getting a one up. Like, I find that a lot more interesting, especially in today's 2D Mario games, in which you can have like 130 lives after a while if you're pretty good.
Yeah.
So I think that's a cool mechanic I wish they'd bring back.
Yeah, lives become kind of a joke in Super Mario. I will say new Super Mario Wii U got pretty difficult towards the end, but you know, for this game, like, the real big problem that I had was just on, you get your 6 coins and you go to Wario's castle, which is really Mario's castle, and you have to deal with some really difficult platforming. And I really got lucky. I had 24 lives when I got to Wario's castle, and I beat the game with 3.
Oh wow!
So it was like a Castlevania like memorization of the level structure to make sure you know exactly what to do when you need to do it. And for me, maybe it was just kind of like the D pad was a little squishy on my Game Boy Pocket, but it. Some of those platforming sections where you need to jump on these platforms that break apart as soon as you touch them. So you have to have like pitch perfect jumping and platforming where I was like dying over again. And that's why I feel really bad that I'm in an apartment complex where there's, you know, some poor Japanese people next door where they're hearing me drop F bombs and shit and saying F this and F that and like wanting to throw my Game Boy. But that is the only hard part. And then even when you get to Wario, like, Wario is pretty easy as the boss. Like, it's not really hard. It's just getting to him is the hard part because there's no checkpoints in that stage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. And that's what it should be in a Mario game, you know, and a great platformer, is that the last level or the last few levels should just be tough platforming.
Yeah.
You know, instead of a really tough boss fight. So this game gets it right in a lot of ways.
And it's real, like with the feature of that battery save, like the game does a really, depends how you look at it, but it does a really good job of, as a portable game, it saves every single time you finish a level. So there aren't like those checkpoints in Super Mario World where you need to beat like a ghost house or a castle. But you also have it save every time you lose a life. So it's not like if you get to Wario's castle and you lose a bunch of lives and you shut it off and then you'll start it back up and you'll have the same amount of lives as you did when you turned it on the first time. It saves every single time, so you need to make sure you beat that castle with the lives that you have left. Otherwise, if you're starting to get low, make sure you shut the console off before like that ending like death music plays. Otherwise you're going to be screwed, or you could perhaps corrupt your data. You know, don't want to hold down the reset button before you shut off your console.
Good point.
That's a NES joke. So let's go around. Let's give it, I don't even want to give this a grade, but let's just say, Josh, you think this is worth, you know, you got a 3DS, or maybe let's just say it's under $10 on the Game Boy. You think it's worth experiencing, worth picking up if you haven't played it before?
8.9 out of 10.
You sure you don't want the, you don't want like a 1,000-point scale for that?
Yeah, let's see. I think it might be like 873.41.
The PC magazines that would have like an 87. I think it was like PC Gamer too that did like 87.5% was the grade.
Got an 87. Like, yeah, what is your rubric?
No, it's
like as somebody who grades a lot of stuff, I wonder about that sometimes. But no, like absolutely, this game is one of the three best Game Boy games you can buy.
Whoa!
It's boom. Take that.
What are the other two?
Yeah, I know. I just realized that you guys were going to ask me that. Now I'd have to think of answers.
Well, it's Link's Awakening and Pokemon.
Yeah, I was going to say Link's Awakening and the original Tetris, actually.
Sure.
But the original Pokemon is very important, certainly. But I think this series got a lot better over time.
No, I think it was the same game over and over again.
Yes, so graphically. But yeah, you could argue that, certainly, that pretty much it peaked right then. But anyway.
We should totally do that for an episode. I touched Pokemon X and Y, but I was like, this is the same game I played in 1998 with my friends in middle school. So maybe we should go back and play Red and Blue.
Yeah, why not? Those aren't on the virtual console, are they?
No, why would they be? Because Nintendo wants you to buy the new Pokemon game because it's the same one.
True, yeah, $40. But yeah, this is $4.
Sorry, Nintendo. I buy more Nintendo games, and I actually bought 3 Wii U games this week, believe it or not, and I don't even have the ability to play them.
Well, the thing with Nintendo is that it's like a child you love. You know, like, you're so invested in them and you want them to do well.
It's a child that disappoints me with lots of potential.
But that's the thing. Right. The sky's the limit. But they sometimes come home drunk.
Yeah. It's like, yeah. Okay.
High school party.
Peter, what do you think? This is a thumbs up, a recommendation, or, you know, you can use the GameSpot scale, whatever you would like to use.
I don't want to give this a number score. I wish we didn't have to do that at GameSpot, but it's part of our system. For me, like, looking at this as a 3DS downloadable title, I might recommend putting money towards like an NES game or something. Mm. But if you're looking for generic, you know, old school Game Boy games to play, I would agree that this is definitely one that should be picked up. I mean, I would spend upwards of $20 on it, you know, because I think it's that good. But at this point in the market, that's, you don't have to pay that much. So I think it's a steal. And I think I got my copy of this game only about last year for like $2 or $3, which is just, I mean, it's ridiculous. This game is great. And to be able to get a great game that cheaply is even better. So for the sheer variety and the relative greatness of the game in so many, you know, ways compared to the rest of the library, I think it's a fantastic game. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more in a second, but if you know, you want to talk about retro game prices going nuts, Game Boy, some of that stuff is still okay. And if you are, you know, not able to afford any more Super Nintendo games, get a Super Game Boy and start playing some Game Boy games on that thing. All right, well, we're going to be back for one more segment talking about some retro gaming news and discussion stuff. So stick around. We'll be back with that in just a second. Segment that has no main structure, but I wanted to talk about a couple things just because it has come up in the news. First off, I mean, people have already talked a lot about this, so I will say, I did, as someone that has been critical of the 3DS hardware as being something that has amazing games on it, but the hardware is just kind of lacking, I did get to play with a new 3DS quite a bit this week, and it is a really nice looking console. The only problem is I was not able to jack in my headphones, so I wasn't able to test probably my biggest complaint with the console and the 3DS XL of having weak headphone output. But in terms of the hardware itself, it feels great. The nub thing feels great. They had demo kiosks with Metal or Monster Hunter 4G and also Super Smash Brothers on it. And thing that people are talking about is the 3D, and the 3D is way better. There's no doubt about that, but that's not really a huge selling point for me. Peter, did you get to play with one of those while you're out here for TGS?
No, I wasn't. Some coworkers were, but I did get a new 3DS LL in the office.
Oh, nice.
Last week. So I've been toying around with it a little bit of my own. The 3D is so much better. And while, like you, I probably don't use it very often, if I'm playing something like Star Fox 64 3D, I really do appreciate having that option there. And yeah, it just uses those two cameras to track where you are, and you can tilt the system. And the sweet spot in terms of having that stereoscopic 3D work is just much larger. It feels great. The nub, I haven't had a chance to use in a game just yet. It's really, really stiff.
Yeah.
But from what I gather, it's also responsive. So the stiffness isn't really a hindrance to the gameplay, but it kind of took me by surprise when I first put my thumb on it.
I did not realize. Yeah, when I was playing Monster Hunter 4, which is a game that, I mean, I haven't really played many of the Monster Hunter games, but you're just talking about like a dual stick camera action thing. It felt really good. It's hard to describe, but it does what you expect it to do when you push as hard as you do.
Sure.
So it felt responsive, and I'm guessing, you know, in any of those games, you're going to be able to go into the menus and, you know, adjust the sensitivity or the speed of the camera like you would in a first person shooter or a third person game. But I think the thing that impressed me the most, and I got to, you know, see when I was at 8-4, John Riccardi got one of the small white ones, much better build quality than the previous models. And that is another big selling point, just because it looks like we're going to have these for another 2 or 3 years. So that is it's worth getting. Like, that's why I got the Game Boy Pocket. And it's, you know, better hardware, something I'm willing to pay for. So hopefully Nintendo brings these out to the U.S. soon. And I just pray to God that they made it so they're not trying to protect three-year-olds' ears with the headphone output. Because, you know, I have $100 headphones. Like, I want to hook up to that thing, like with the Vita, that has no problem doing. And even the Game Boy Pocket, I hooked up my Audio-Technica ATH-50s, which are like $130 headphones, and that thing was able to power those headphones perfectly. It sounded great. Like, I had tunes from Super Mario Land 2 and Castlevania 2 blasting in my head, and it sounded awesome.
Let me ask you about the standard size for the new 3DS, because from what I gather, it's got a larger screen relative to the regular 3DS that's already available, right? How did that compare as like a portable experience? Because I like my XL. There are times where I miss the, you know, having my original 3DS, but I don't miss that small screen. So this sounds like kind of the perfect fit is going with the smaller version of the new 3DS. But I mean, how was that for you?
I mean, after seeing John's, like, I am sold on the smaller one. It is, It's a couple things. First off, the new 3DS LL or XL is actually heavier than the old one. And it's not that much, but when you think about the portability of the thing, the new 3DS looks so great. Like, the white one looks fantastic, and, you know, I don't really give a crap about the face plates, but they're kind of cool, you know, and to be able to
get like the wood grain one, man, that's really classy.
Yeah, John got the wood grain one, which is like $20-something. He just turned his console like up into the $200, you know, console range. But, you know, sure, if you want to have like a nice station wagon look, like a 1980s station wagon look to your console, that's a good way to do it. But I just the last thing I really need to see is that headphone output. And it sounds dumb that is such a big thing for me, but when I'm on a plane and I have my headphones on playing A Link Between Worlds and I can barely hear the music over the, you know, the jet engines and things like that, like, that shouldn't happen. Come on. Like, it's have a child safe option thing in the menus to have, like iPods used to and iPhones do, to make it so you can lock the volume at a certain level. But, you know, you should be able to power that thing, especially when there's another thing. I think I talked about on some podcasts, but the battery life is not better. It's like 10% better, which it's not Nintendo. Like, they just haven't given a crap about battery life since the DS Lite. Like, I remember the DS Lite went to the DSi and the battery life got worse. Like, how is that possible? But it is what it is. And I will say, for this whole trip, I have barely touched my 3DS XL, but I've been playing a lot of my Vita. So that is just me. And that's just kind of the way I am. So, I actually saw this morning, Peter, that you reviewed the PS Vita TV, or the PlayStation TV, and not super great.
Yeah, just a really quick summary. It promises a lot of features and they work, but not as well as you would expect for a product that's like ready for market. Yeah, like the remote play thing is a little bit disappointing, but mostly it's the software support. Sony's using a whitelist for every category of software that's supported on that thing, and that's going to be a problem when new games come out if Sony doesn't have, you know, a firmware approving that game to work. And even something like Netflix doesn't work, which is just absurd.
That boggles my mind, because I thought this was going to be the device that, like, you know, replaces like a Roku or something for someone, you know, or whatever, like an Amazon Fire TV. Like, this would be up against those devices.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure that support's going to come, and I'm not positive if it's, you know, either Netflix or Sony that's to blame. But I can't imagine that there wasn't someone inside Sony saying, hey guys, we should probably make sure this works by the time we ship. And they had a long lead time. I mean, they finalized this hardware over a year ago, and it's been available in Japan for a long time.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
This is it's done in the United States.
It's a shame, because if you look on Amazon, like I was checking them out on Amazon just because, you know, I was thinking about picking one up. I actually bought one of the Japanese ones, and I didn't open it for 3 months, so I sold them on eBay. But the in the US, like, people are hammering it for not being able to do remote play well, and like you said, Peter, not being able to play a bunch of games that you think it would. Like, you even mentioned in your review that they couldn't play some PSP games like Castlevania Dracula X Chronicles. Like, you should, like, there's no technical reason it shouldn't be able to do it. It's probably just like licensing or some stupid stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it could be licensing, but shit. I mean, if Sony is still selling that, you know, there's no real distinction apart from the lack of screen and buttons between a Vita and a PlayStation TV. So I find it hard to imagine that they would have to relicense it just for that platform.
Well, I guess it's like the same thing with like some PS1 games are not available on the PlayStation Vita store, but you can download them to your PS3, then transfer them, because they're licensed to be transferred to a portable like, it is, like, that's in the wording. It can be transferred to a portable device from your PS3. That's the wording that was in for the PSP when you could transfer that stuff, but you cannot download it directly, like Metal Gear Solid. I have to download that to a PS3, then put it on my Vita.
Yeah, that exact game is the one that I've done that with.
It's probably like the only one that people really care about, but it's just, man, companies are so weird. They, like, again, these are some things that you think a lot of people would be doing, you know, they would fix these things. Like, these are, like, we are thinking of this stuff. How are people that are getting paid, you know, to do this professionally, to develop this stuff, not thinking of this stuff? Or maybe there's some legal hurdles with all that. Yeah, shame. We talked a little bit earlier in the show about retro gaming stuff, and I wanted to bring this topic up for a second, retro game shopping, because Chris Kohler pointed to, I think it was Dan Fite that posted something on Twitter from a Japanese forum that was specifically talking about foreigners coming into Japan and clearing out all the games from Japan, and how there are literally, you know, no games, or there's a lot fewer games. Like, a lot of games are just, people are coming to Japan, bringing the games out. And of course, another thing that people are doing is just buying games on eBay. Now people are willing to get those 100, like from Hit Japan, getting 100 Super Famicom games where 90 of them are junk for $300. And all those games are just leaving, and they're not getting replenished, and they're not coming back to the used stores. And I think that is totally accurate. Like, I've been seeing, like, when I go into the Trader store last week, even though TGS is at, like, a couple weeks ago, like, there's still, I would almost say, like, 20% foreigners in there looking for games. Like, there's lots of people that are not from Japan trying to get good deals there, because if you want to get something like Turtles in Time on eBay, like, I looked today as an example because I saw that in Trader the other day, and that's kind of a rare game here. But on eBay right now, that's going for, like, $60.
Yeah,
For a loose copy of Turtles in Time, and that was like $30 a year and a half ago. Prices are just getting ridiculous, so it is making a lot of people just say, "Oh, maybe I'll spend $1,000 on a flight to Japan, buy $1,000 worth of games. I bet I could get the equivalent of $2,000 if I bought on eBay for the same games, and as long as it's not an RPG where I need to read, I'll be good to go."
And you get a trip to Japan in the process, so, you know, not a bad thing.
Yeah, it's a twofer, no doubt. But the only success I've really had, a little bit at Trader, but I've really just been shopping at my local shop in Koshigaya, where I've gotten tons of great deals. Still, I like I've picked that place to the bone. If it's something worth buying there, I've bought it. It's just a shame that I guess there's the stocks are just running low everywhere. It's just people are really getting into retro gaming now, which is, I guess, a good thing for all of us. Unless you want to buy this stuff, but I know Peter, you're still doing the, I'm guessing, did you go to the flea market today? Was a little bit too early, or were you a little too tired from the charity stuff?
So I've actually moved, within San Francisco. I'm now pretty far out from the flea market. So, I actually haven't been in a while. And part of that is because I'm far away. The other part of that is because it's been really slim pickings.
Yeah.
Now, granted, if you're into the flea market game, you know that that's not really, you don't really want to fall into the trap of thinking like, well, there was nothing there last week. Why should I go this week? Because that's exactly when something is going to show up.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I did a lot of shopping when I was in Japan. I think I bought, too many games.
Sounds about right.
Yep. But, you know, it's interesting you brought up the whole aspect of foreigners coming in to buy games because, well, and the price hikes because, like, for example, last March I was in Tokyo and there was a copy of the Sunsoft game Hagane, which the American version is very expensive. Years ago in Japan, I bought a loose copy for $11. I was like, great. But that game has such great box art. And that game is pretty special. Apart from being expensive and sought after, it's actually just a really great game that came at the end of the Super Nintendo life cycle. So I was in Japan in March. I wanted a complete copy. I was in Mandarake in Akihabara, and they had a complete copy for $100. At that time, I was like, you know, I know on eBay I can get it for like $80 complete for the Super Famicom version. I'm just not going to buy it yet. Meanwhile, I get home and I start looking it up and I was like, okay, no, it's starting to go up. Like people are starting to buy the Japanese version because they can't afford the $300 loose copy for the American cart. I go back to Japan this time and I'm in the Mandarake in the Nakano Mall in Tokyo and I see a complete copy for $170 and I'm like, okay. And I had seen many other copies that were $200 plus before that, this last trip. So I said, okay, I have to buy this now. I can't wait for this game to keep going up in price because it absolutely will. I had this feeling when I was thinking about, okay, these games are going up in price. It means everybody wants them. And here I am coming and just taking it out of this country. I felt like a little bit like a grave robber.
I totally hear you.
Oh, yeah.
And you almost feel like people are looking at you. Like, you now, yeah. I feel like I'm going into these shops and I mentioned her on the show, like in the past, like the woman at Friends is the lady that runs the retro section of Friends or the Famicom or the, you know, not the Sega Saturn section, the first floor, is always super nice. But you can tell like when people come in there now, you're just like, oh man, they're just taking our games, but I'm sure she's doing all right because she's increased her prices too. So at least she's making, you know, some more money off this stuff.
Sure. Yeah, it's a strange feeling. But, you know, and then I think to myself, okay, I know that I'm going to protect these games. Like, I know I'm going to keep them in good shape and alive. And I can't say, well, I would imagine anyone in Japan would do the same thing because they do care so much about condition and caring for these things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just, that's kind of the only voice in the back of my head that keeps me from maybe backing away from taking their precious games. But
well, it's a case where, you know, people like us are gonna buy it and keep it and play it like we buy it to play it, where you know, I'm sure there's, and unfortunately you do see some of this online, whether it be on forums and stuff like that, where people will basically just buy a ton of stuff, take it home, sell it on eBay, even, you know, jacking up the prices even more on a lot of this stuff. So you know, my advice for people right now, and like I was going to say this a little bit later, but if you think you're into this stuff, just start thinking a little bit preemptively and look at prices of Wii software right now, PSP games and DS games.
Yeah,
buy that stuff right now because PSP games are super cheap. Like a lot of like the best games out there are like $10, $15, under $20. Same thing with like DS games, like those DS Castlevania games. Buy them right now while they're still in stock at Amazon, because as soon as those are gone, you got to keep in mind they're like in 10 years, those games are going to be $60, $80, especially if it's a cart based and not a disc based game where you can feel better about it. But for this trip, I've been mostly almost exclusively, except for when I've been in Koshigai, I bought some Super Famicom stuff, but mostly I've been buying Dreamcast games and Sega Saturn games because those are still pretty cheap, where everything like PC Engine, Super Famicom, Famicom, like don't even touch Mega Drive stuff. Like Mega Drive stuff is getting super hard to find. But all that stuff is going nuts. So I would say just start looking at, think ahead, think of what's not expensive now. And even like Game Boy stuff in Japan is still decent. But all the disc based stuff, like your PS1, PS2 games, start buying that stuff right now. Because it's 10 years from now, it's going to be like what it is for Super Nintendo and, you know, Nintendo stuff.
It's really great advice.
This is endless cycle of chasing value. It's just for, you know, in the name of things that we love and wish that we had.
I hope I've done a lot of talking about Nintendo today, but I hope they're seeing this, and I hope they are seeing what, like, people want to play this stuff. And the Wii U eShop and the Nintendo 3DS virtual consoles, I should say, have been really terrible, you know, for the last year. And the support has been garbage. There's here and there, there'll be, you know, like, God, where's the N64 support on Wii U? Like, where you announced it at the launch of the Wii U. It is why it's hard for me to support those shops, is because I feel like they don't give a crap. And hopefully they can figure out a way to make it so it is worth giving a crap about. But I would love to be able to, you know, get more games on the Wii U and the Nintendo 3DS eShop. And hopefully with the new 3DS, God, I hope they can figure out how to get Super Nintendo games on that thing, and the like Game Boy Advance games, because those games, you know, Game Boy Advance games, great that they're on the Wii U. Those should be on a portable console. They are portable games. You know what? My old PSP with the hacked firmware, it can play Game Boy Advance games. It can play Super Nintendo games. It can play Genesis games really well, too. So that is unacceptable, is what I'm going to say. But if you'll do it, I have money that I will put in that account, and I will buy games, just because you're getting to that point where, do you want to spend $50 on, you know, insert game, or do you want to spend $8 to get the eShop version? A lot of times, you know what, I'll just spend $8, you know, to play for the show, because it's going to be a good version of it. Scary times we live in, folks.
Indeed.
Scary times.
You were talking about a minute ago, Kevin, with thinking ahead. Like, you know, I think with, you're seeing it happen with GameCube games right now, especially. Like, you know, if you had bought this stuff when GameStop and various other stores were clearing them out a couple of years ago, you could be doing pretty well. Whereas now, things like the Mario Party games, for instance, are really expensive if you just go try to buy them on eBay, like complete in box and everything. So, yeah, I mean, it might even be too late for some of the consoles. Like, you might have to start thinking, like you were talking about, like PSP and DS and some systems like that.
Yeah, seriously, get on. I know I'm like kind of being hard on this, but stop what you're doing right now and literally go on Amazon and start looking up those games, like the Konami games, the Capcom games, the Nintendo games that you know are going to be going up in price once they are not showing up from Amazon or third party sellers anymore, and buy them now. Like those Castlevania games for $20 are worth buying. Contra 4 for $20 is worth buying. Get that stuff now. Yeah. That's your back in my play public service announcement for this episode of the show. You know, I just want to briefly mention that there are some good CD soundtracks here in Japan. That's another benefit of being here, is that there's just, like, you can get, I just picked up Castlevania Best Selection 2, which is CD soundtracks, 2-disc of Super Castlevania 4 and the first two Game Boy games on CD. It's just kind of, it's kind of crazy. Like, you can just pick that stuff up in Japan where you can't really get it in America. So I don't know why I want to mention that, but it's just, if you are looking for that stuff, it's out there if you're willing to import it. And Amazon does ship some of that stuff to America. So you can take a look at that, but, or getting like the Mother 1 and 2 soundtracks on CD, or all the, you know, your favorite Konami and Capcom games. Like, you can find those CD soundtracks. I even found, last night in for 300 yen, CD soundtracks for Samurai, Showdown, in, my local shop. that the original version and or like an orchestral version of the soundtrack of that game for 300 yen a piece. And like those are another thing. If you come to Japan and you want soundtracks, look in the CD shops. Like you can find those for pretty cheap. But yeah, that's
that stuff in a separate section, Kevin.
Oh yeah, it's like in the music section or the CD section, but just look for, there's tons of Square soundtracks, so look for the Square logo, the Square Enix logo on the spines of CDs, or also for like CD soundtracks to anime and stuff like that. Like you'll be able to, that stuff That's stands out. Okay. So you can look in there, but even like last night I bought Final Fantasy 1 and 2, the original soundtrack from like 1988 or 1990, whenever it came out. Which is just kind of cool to have. So yeah, that's that. And I will mention for the next episode, Greg Seward is going to be on to talk about the history or the legacy of SegaNet, just because I got like buying all these Dreamcast games. I'm like, man, it was so great playing these on online, like NBA 2K and all that stuff. And, Quake 3. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And when I was on 8th4 last, we've made plans to record Zelda 2, I think, this week. So that might be not next episode, but the episode after that. I have to play that hunk of garbage, or at least enough to talk about it. But it's hopefully just going to be them talking about it, because I really don't want to play it. I played about an hour of it last night, just leveling up. Nothing but farming XP.
Just watch a YouTube long play of it or something.
I just can't do that. I'm too locked in with the show. And also I'm going to meet up with Nick Dwyer later this week. So we might record something. I'm going to meet up with him for like coffee or something. So I might bring my portable recorder to talk about the finishing of Digging in the Carts. And of course the Digging in the Carts concert that is coming up. But lastly, before we go, I want to mention that Josh was on Radio Free Nintendo this week. So if you want to listen to people that love Nintendo talk about Nintendo, you can listen to that.
How did that go? Pretty funny episode. It got really interesting because Guillaume brought in Wii Music as his game that he had played. And so that got really dark for a little while talking about that. Hmm.
Yeah, I gotta, you know, I'm always thinking, I know you guys love Nintendo, but it's always, I've listened to a couple episodes in the past, and at least they are critical of Nintendo when it needs to be. It's a good podcast to check out. And, I wanted to, also mention, you know, go check out Player One too. They're always doing good stuff. But Peter, you got anything cool coming up? Like I said, you're doing some streaming for charity for Extra Life. And actually, you know what was funny? I was, before I came out here, I was looking for a clip. I was looking for a clip about the Wii Virtual Console in Japan on the 1UP show. And when one of those, I was like looking through all the 1UP shows looking for it, and you popped up on the 1UP show talking about like a, I think it was Killzone.
Yeah. Like, I was actually thinking about that the other day. I used to work at 1UP.com on the video production team. And, and they started integrating me into the 1UP show a little bit. Like I was on a few of the opening skits. And then I had gotten an invite to the Killzone 2 beta. And so I played it. And then they had me and it was, David?
That was such a funny shoot because like he had been reviewing games forever and I was kind of this just guy who had been doing video stuff, but we had very different opinions on the game.
Yeah, it was something about the control of the gun when you were firing it or something like that.
Exactly.
Like you couldn't control the gun.
Like, well, he thought that it was sort of unreal, like the behavior of the gun was unrealistic, and my argument was, who cares? This is a game. Like I think the way that they've designed it is fun to play, and if they had changed it and made it more realistic, well, it might not have been as fun. Like I'm not concerned that Killzone isn't sticking to real world gun physics so much. in terms of things coming up, I've got an interview with the people behind Project Scissors. Who worked on the Clock Tower games. There's the artist from the original Silent Hill.
Oh, that's awesome.
First few games. Yeah, and so I've got an interview with them talking about their upcoming projects. And as you mentioned Nick Dwyer, I actually spoke with him a couple weeks ago and put up an interview with him about 2 weeks ago. And he's a great guy to talk to. That series is wonderful. So I definitely want to give a shout out to Digging in the Carts. Like, everybody should watch that. Mm-hmm. It's so well done. And he gets some great people on board. And he said that he's got some footage that didn't make it on the show that hopefully we'll be able to get on a GameSpot. So in the next week or two, we should be able to get that up there.
Oh, yeah, you got to imagine that they just have so much B-roll and so much extra footage that they shot from that, because and that was something we talked about when I was on A4, like just how, you know, how you wish those things weren't 15 minutes long, but they were like 60 minutes long for each like era that they talked about.
Yeah.
But of course, you got budgetary constraints and constraints of the format that Red Bull put forth. But yeah, that'll be awesome to check out. I can't wait to see that. So guys, make sure you are following. Okay, let's take a step back. I want you to make sure you do a couple things. First off, I want you to make sure that you are checking out Back in My Play on iTunes. Submit a review on there if you enjoy the show. We had someone that said that I sounded like a robot and it made my feelings hurt. So it would make me feel better. And they also said that I talk over everyone, which I don't think I ever do, but you know, it might be a Skype thing. If you enjoy the show, it would make me feel a lot better. It would make me feel less likely to make a compulsive order to Domino's in Japan to feed my feelings. If you could go on there and submit a review and subscribe on there, because it also helps us jump up in the ratings there. You can also follow Peter at PC Round on Twitter. So make sure you're doing that so you can keep an eye out for, that interview and that stuff with Digging in the Carts too. And of course, Peter is really fronting the retro gaming scene at GameSpot and, you know, fighting the good fight to make sure that there's some good retro gaming content out there. So if you're listening to this, you're going to want to check out Peter and his stuff. And of course, Josh is at Joshua Hillier on Twitter. And, Josh posts some stuff on Twitter too. He sometimes talks to himself. It's kind of weird. But it also, he also gives you updates on, things that are going on at his alma mater and, music stuff, which is good. And when he's on Radio Free Nintendo and Player One podcast.
Yeah. I'm a must follow. My goodness. The 100 and something followers would have to agree on that.
I did just pass 5,000, so thank you everyone out there
that you're blowing up.
Gives a crap about. Well, it's not from this podcast; it's mostly from my fitness podcast. But still, I appreciate everyone that puts up with fitness stuff. If you like this show or the gaming stuff, if you like my other show, although I do get a lot of people that listen to both, which is you guys are the best. So check all that stuff out at Back in My Play on Twitter. I do some game giveaways on there, so if you ever want an eShop code, I'm giving away stuff on there. But I apologize that we missed a couple weeks. Now that I'm settled here in Japan, I'm back on the horse and I've got some games that I want to play, which is really important. Like I said, Zelda 2, Sega Net, and Castlevania 2 on the Game Boy. Kirk Kalata agreed, although he doesn't love that game, to come back on. I just want to play it because I love listening to the soundtrack. That's it. Thank you from myself, from Josh, and from Peter. And we will see you next time. Hopefully you go and take our advice, buy those PSP, DS, PS2 games, Dreamcast games. Do it now before you can't buy them anymore. Thanks.